Welcome to us online and good morning, everybody here. Sound is okay at the back there? Okay, so we're doing this third class on death and rebirth. So it's made up of a number of different parts. We begin with some prayers and a brief meditation. Then I'll present the material. There'll be a section where you can ask questions or have anything clarified, and then we'll do a meditation. We'll sort of do this three times. So please get comfortable in your seat and we'll begin the first part of the morning. So let your shoulders relax, make sure your back is straight. Put your hands wherever you like. And you can keep your eyes open or close them or keep them partially open. Now just let your body breathe itself. And while your body is breathing itself, just relax into your awareness of that. Then imagine that the ground beneath you is of the nature of a starry sapphire light. It's as soft as the palm of a baby's hand. And all space is filled with rainbows and offerings. And in the space in front of you, on the lion throne, sitting on a cushion of a lotus sun and moon, is Buddha Shakyamuni. He's surrounded by the assembly of the direct and indirect teachers. So there are Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, deities, and other enlightened beings. And now you recollect how fortunate you are to still be alive and to have the leisure and opportunity to engage in a spiritual path and accomplish your spiritual goals. But it's important to act quickly. This is because there isn't anything that is staying the same. Everything is disintegrated. And the disintegration for us eventuates in our death. And if we do not recollect the fact of our death, we will forget the Dharma. And if we forget the Dharma, then we're not going to practice Dharma. If we do practice Dharma, but we've forgotten death, the practice will not be true. Then it won't have any strength. And basically, you're cheating yourself. And so you'll die with regret. Whereas if you do remember your certain death and that it could take place at any moment, then your practice becomes very beneficial. You start off purely. It becomes powerful because whenever you recollect your own death, you will not engage with disturbing emotions. So the recollection of death and impermanence is the right way to start practice at the beginning, middle, and end. And it finishes with you actually dying with a sense of joy. So until that takes place, we need to rely upon a spiritual friend who will lead us in the safe direction of the three rare sublime ones. The Buddha, his teachings, and the spiritual community. So, to make your offering as practice, off practice as purely as possible, imagine that you're surrounded by all sentient beings. Beside you on the left is your mother. Beside you on the right is your father. And behind you are your family and closest friends. Or in front of you are the people you've had misunderstandings and difficulties with. Surrounding these groups of people are many others who are at present strangers to you. Which means you've basically forgotten your relationships with them throughout countless past lives. So to make the offering of practice pure, see yourself as clear as the deity. You're holding a vajra and bell. And you are within a sphere of great bliss. There were the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas in front of you. And being surrounded by all sentient beings, say, I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Ascendant. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Ascendant. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Ascendant. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. In response to this wish of yours, think from the heart of each enlightened being, lights and nectar stream down, and these dissolve into yourself and all living beings. And these lights and nectars purify negative karma and obstructions. They increase your health and lifespan, your virtues and your realizations. Feeling fresh and clean and empowered, recollect the four immeasurable thoughts. Decide to establish these within yourself and help all sentient beings attain the four immeasurable accomplishments. To solidify this and to make it meaningful, join me in saying, may all sentient beings have happiness and its causes. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and its causes. May all sentient beings never be separated from the happiness that is without suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from the bias of attachments for friends and hatred for enemies. And so I'll do this. Then exhale and relax a little more. And from that state of relaxed awareness, imagine the field for a few days' merit appears. And you say in front of it, reverently, I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since beginning this time and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of psychic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own and other spirits to the great enlightenment. Now, to prevent ourselves from clinging to the merit and the purified state we feel to be inherently real, we imagine that our body, speech, mind, our enjoyments, and our virtue are all transformed into a wonderful and pure land where all beings can abide and take the teachings of the Buddha. And we offer this pure land to the field for accumulated merit. And so we say, this ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun and the moon. I imagine this as a Buddha field of offering. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Idam Guru Raptam Mandala. We've released the offering. The Buddha accepts it with joy and he smiles at us. We look up into the smiling eyes of the Buddha. And looking into those eyes, we find immense humility, kindness, wisdom, and acceptance. And we recollect, we remember our wish to put an end to suffering. We want to do it for the sake of all beings, and it depends upon the correct view. And then from the heart of the Buddha, infinite light rays emanate. And these reach all environments and all beings. And everything dissolves into light, which dissolves into the Buddha. The Buddha begins to diminish in size. He moves through space. Comes to abide above the crown of your head, and then descends from down through your body down to your heart. At the bare face of your own innate mind, with the covering of the perception of true existence and perceiving it as true, it vanishes. And your mind and the body of the Buddha become of one nature. And in this union, you can hear the sounds of the mantra of the Buddha. And here you begin to recite it, saying, Tayatam Muni Mahamudaya Sama. So from your heart, rays of light fill within the rest of the space. And every sentient being abiding within space is utterly transformed into the fully awakened state. So the two purposes are achieved. The light begins to withdraw from the two directions of space and re-enters your heart. You become aware of the body breathing itself. You can feel the seat you're sitting upon, and sounds are heard. If you're embodied once again, in being embodied, you realize that this was a meditation of imagination. It has imprinted the mind with the potential for the actualization of what you've imagined. You know that for this actualization to take place, you need to rely upon an authentic teacher, acknowledge the death that will take place in this life of yourself, and how you need to protect yourself from the future occurrence. Occurrences that take place after death. You want to engage with the spiritual path that brings about the full awakening for the benefit of all beings. And you think to yourself, yes, that's exactly what I want to do. And you breathe in deeply through your nostrils. You exhale through your mouth and let your eyes flash open. And you return your attention to wherever you are. Okay, so hi everybody, welcome to class. So you know we're going through this course called Death and Rebirth, and here I just want to look at what we've already covered. So we began by looking at gross and subtle impermanence. So gross impermanence basically means the fact of death. You can actually see a major change take place. Subtle impermanence is referring to the very subtle changes that are not really aware to your senses. I mean, all of us are changing right now, right? But it doesn't look like that's what's going on. And that's what subtle impermanence is referring to. Very, very small changes that we're unaware of. So we looked at that in the first teaching, and we also looked at the eight worldly concerns. So the eight worldly concerns are mental behaviors that get in the way of authentic Dharma practice. There are two sets of pairs. So one is we have attachment to fame, gain, pleasure, and praise, and aversion to infamy, loss, pain, and criticism. So we've got to meet these different things. Right? The problem here is the attachment and aversion. That's the thing. It's not the fact that we are rich or well, looked at. That's not the problem. Or that you're poor or that you're criticized. These are not the problems. It's the attachment or the aversion that we have to them. This is the major problem. So we looked at those. And then we looked at the disadvantages of forgetting death. So I ran through those in our meditation. If we forget our certain death, then we forget Dharma, then we forget the practice. Whatever practice we do is impure, because this is based on these eight worldly concerns. Then our practice of Dharma is very weak. It doesn't have much strength. And you'll find, if you try and do this, you'll find that you don't have much perseverance in Dharma practice. Lots of things get in the way, you very easily give it up. And basically, you just sort of cheat yourself. Really. I think the eight worldly concerns are cheating us. We just get involved with aversion and attachment. And of course, at the end, it's like, so what will we accomplish with this life? We look back on it from our deathbed and go, like, what do I actually do? You might find it's not very much. So you might then die with regret, which is not a good way to die. We don't want to die like that. So to prevent that, we need to recollect the fact of our death. Like every day. So our practice is not rooted in the eight worldly concerns. It's for beyond this life. If we aim that way, all the good things that we need in this life will come to us anyway. Because if we wish to have a good rebirth, we have to die with a virtuous mind. So the attachment and the aversion work against virtue. So practice becomes very beneficial when you recollect certainty of death. It becomes powerful because every time you think of death, it's pointless to be upset. It's like, what's the point? What's the point of getting angry at people and things when we know we're going to die? So practice becomes beneficial. This recollection is very good at the beginning of practice, the middle, brings us all the way to the end so that we can actually die with a sense of joy. That's the best way to die. If we don't have joy, then there should be no sort of fear. And if without that, we still die content, in other words. And without that, at least we die without any regrets. So that's what we looked at last week. So what I would suggest you do in this life, while we're still alive, look back over your life and think, are there things that I regret right now? Because if there are, do what you can to alter it. Because you do not want that sort of thought at the time of death. You don't want to be looking at what you did unskillfully during life and then die. So while you have the chance, sort it out now as quickly as you can so that you can go, okay, done. Like I said, so we just talked about the advantages of recollecting death then. Now today, we're going to look at the type of meditation we actually, this is the meditation to, okay, so you sort of do this as often as you can, like, this is the meditation you try and do it like every day. And it's based around what they call the three roots and the nine reasons. And out of this process comes three resolutions, three ideas. You go, okay, that's what I have to do. Then the people who set this course up that I'm running, right, they say, look, see if you can convince a 16-year-old to recollect death and repentance. I was going, yeah, good luck with that. I know for myself, for me, the most powerful thing that can happen to you to convince you of your own death and repentance is have a good friend die when you're young. And so when I grew up in New Zealand, big drinking culture in New Zealand, right? Everyone gets drunk and it starts really young. So by the time I was 11, I was drinking. My dad had a still. He used to make his own beer. So we were always in there sneaking the beer and sharing it with our mates. And of course, everybody used to drive drunk. Right? And then one day, five of our schoolmates were all killed in this one day of the road accident. And that happened a few more times too. I mean, just because it shocked everybody, of course. And, you know, we were, whoa, okay. So then we were driving in cars, drunk and speeding for a couple of years. And then, you know, the other young people forget. A new lot of people come along and the behavior continues. So really need something powerful, I think, when you're young to sort of pay attention. So we've got to come up with some sort of idea, like how would you convince a 16-year-old? What might you say to them? What would be useful for them to hear now that might stop them and have them think about their own death and impermanence? So you know, I've come up with something, I don't know how successful it would be, but you have to come up with something too. you know, we're trying to convince ourselves. And I'm sure if you can convince yourself at 16, you can convince yourself now. So anyway, that's what we're going to be looking at today. We'll go through this. Of course, the books did not change. They're basically the same. And all these books have this type of meditation in it. So I'm going to start off with some of this slide first. I usually have the slide after we've talked a bit about it. But I want to put it up first to tell you a little bit about this meditation. So it is it's called the three roots, the nine reasons, the three conclusions, and it is an analysis. It's an analytical process. So it's got a structure to it. And this structural framework, its purpose is to bring about a transformation of mind. So it's not a casual reflection. You know, if you say to someone, what do you think about death? It'd be just like something just pop out of your mouth. Really. And it's something you just sit there and think, oh, I'm going to die. That's my reflection. So it's not like that, as you'll see. It's made up of these points and then supporting points and then, so what do I do with that information? And what its purpose is to do is to shift our ordinary perception, our ordinary way of thinking. Because our ordinary way of thinking is, let's not think about death. But we don't, basically, do we? Until you've got a friend dying or you yourself in the hospital, that's probably the only time you'll ever think of it. So it's sort of saying, well, yeah, we're sort of going against that, aren't we? You go, yeah, we are. And it's purposeful, isn't it? And the purpose is because if you don't do it, you'll forget the Dharma. If you forget the Dharma, then you're not going to practice Dharma. And if you don't remember the whatever Dharma, every practice you do is never pure Dharma. It's always merged up with these eight concerns. Often it's just the happiness of this life. And so that's never going to get you out of cyclic existence. This is what we're trying to sort of transform the ordinary way of looking at things. Let's begin to look. So here, what I'll do is I'll put up one card and it shows you the first, what they call the root, the first thing to think about, then three things that support it, and then the conclusion. That's all one slide, then we'll go through each slide one at a time. So this is the first one. The first root is death is certain. That's the first statement they talk about. They talk about these three things to support this statement. And the first one says that the Lord of Death will certainly come. So this is a personification of death, of course. So we often see that, death with a scythe or he's like a fruited guy. So it's personified death like that. The sort of saying, look, there's no way to avoid this death, right? Lord, this death is the Lord over everything that lives. He's coming. We can't avoid him. Then the second thing to think of is, look, your lifetime cannot be extended. And in fact, it's constantly getting less and less and less. In fact, when you think about this, from the moment we were born, we started to die. We started to age and die. We're moving towards our death from the moment we were born. The third thing is, actually, while you are alive, there is very little time for practice. So many of us come to the Dharma quite late in life. You're probably an exception. You're one of the youngest people here, and yet you're here, right? But many of us, like 40, 50 years old, suddenly it's like, now it dawns on us. And so we don't have much time to practice. Like we have probably 8 to 10 hours sleep a day. There's eating, there's entertainments, there's going to the toilets, there's your housework. There's your job if you have one. There's being a wife and a mother. All that sort of stuff, right? It's like, so when do you practice Dharma here? Well, whatever time you've got left. It's not much. So the conclusion from this is I have to practice Dharma. Even though there's not much time, while all this is happening, I still have to practice Dharma. So now we'll just take each of these and just go through them briefly, and then we'll come to the next major root. So this root here, like death is certain, that's the root. Three supporting reasons are underneath it, and the conclusion is I must practice Dharma. So here, of course, I've just gone along with the usual trope about death, right? So here he is, his big hat, his scythe in his hand, he's already dead, so he's down to the bones. Death is certain, and just like it says, the Lord of Death will certainly come. And it just means death is inescapable. No one has escaped death. So we won't either. Does this make any difference to you? To your thinking right now? Oftentimes it doesn't, because you just agree. You go, yeah, somewhat. I know. You go, yeah, I know. I know that. Everybody knows that. But it doesn't really make much impact. So this is why each day, so I do this meditation, how lucky I am to still be alive today. So when I say that, encapsulating that is all of this. And it's just that one thing that goes, okay, I know all that stuff is goes. Yeah, because death is certain. And the next route, and it's untimely. When is this going to take place? It's uncertain. And I've died a number of different times already. So I know it's certain. And I've had many of the people I grew up with, they're all dead. Many of them through silly things I did. Not many of them through old age. So this is not heart. Like I said, we all know this. And then the next one is this one here. I put the root up every time. Your lifetime cannot be extended. Now this is dependent. There are plenty of instances in the text where, you know, like you say, you might, if you look at our life, this life, you say, okay, so we have cancer or some sort of illness or something comes up, right? Oh, I'm going to die. But then the doctors get involved and they find some sort of solution for it, and you live a little bit longer. So, like I say, it's extended. This is also in the text where you find great practitioners. The mothers give birth to a child, the child is very ill, sick. They go to the lamas, and the lama says, this child will die unless you do this. And then the mother does that. And then after a while it goes back, and they come back and says, yes, you need to, now you need to do this. You need to do this. So we find the same, isn't it? Like, you know, we take healthy pills, we eat good food, we exercise, we're trying to extend our lifespan, have a good life. But it's not indefinite, right? And in fact, like I said, in fact, it's diminishing all the time. Ever since we were born, we're getting closer to death. This is one we're probably not that familiar with. Like to take the idea that, you know, we often think we're as we're growing up, we're like getting bigger, aren't we? Moving towards something. You know, I always wanted to grow up fast when I was a kid. I couldn't wait to get out of childhood. Right? Be an adult, you know, like do the stuff I see all the older people do. Couldn't wait. You know? You don't sort of realize, yeah, you know what happens after that. Now, this old, I look back and go, man, the best years of my life was a kid.
I think the very interesting about this point is there are human beings amongst us who try really, really hard to extend their life. And when you read about what the lengths they're going to, I look and I go, there's so much effort and time spent into extending the life, but what for? It's like, and I literally looked at one person's regime of what they were doing. It literally took up the whole day to extend the life, and they did it again the next day. But I'm like, well, what are you using that time
yeah,
for?
That's right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. What are you, yeah, that's right. If you want to have this long life, what's it for? So I've seen some interesting movies where people have these long lives and they get so fed up with it, they just want to die. And you think, yeah, just because you haven't really worked out what the purpose of your life is. What's going on here? It feels funny. Okay. Now, the next thing, of course, is that the death is certain, of course, and there's not much time to practice Dharma. So I put here this young fellow up here who's really just out with gold and music he wants. I know myself when I was growing up, one of the most important things to me was music. I really like music. So I'm always at concerts, and you know, my interest is music. Of course, you know, I don't know anything about Dharma. Most of us don't when we're growing up. But we get involved in lots of different things, you know. And, you know, when you reach your teenage years, what will happen mostly, if you're a girl, the guys will come after you. And if you're a boy, you're really interested in the girls, right? So you get this sort of thing. Or if you're, you know, if you're bi, well then you, if you're a girl, you go after the girls, you're a boy, you go after the boys. You just work that out. But that sort of thing takes place. And you spend years doing it. So there's that, and then there's work. Right? So, you know, you do that, and you look at it and say, what's it all for? And you go, well, seems to be that you're sort of meant to get married or get in a relationship of some sort, and you get a house, and that's you live in it. You live in it. You know, what for? You know, so if you ask a few questions like, yeah, but why? Why? Don't take long before you know you run out of sensible answers, isn't it? You go like, sure, is that it? So you know, as a person growing up in Algeria, I was going, is that it? Is that the point of life? And it doesn't make much sense to me if that were the point of life. But sometimes it takes quite a bit of time before you come to that conclusion. And so all that time before, I was sort of like, well, I never did any Dharma then. So the conclusion of all of this is that is this. So I have to practice Dharma. Again, to draw that conclusion, you have to know what Dharma is. It's not just saying, well, I must practice Dharma because I'm going to die. You get some of you just say, why? What's the point? So we can't bring up an answer to that. You know, you need to think a bit more, isn't it? So you can't believe this. Doesn't make sense. So one of the major things here, of course, from, you know, like you're going to just come from a Buddhist perspective. Most people would not reflect upon their death. If you ask them why, they'd probably say, what's the point? Behind that is an assumption that when you die, there's nothing else. It's over. So what's the point of reflecting upon your death? Well, it might be that you wish to just live a good life, a meaningful life once. That would help. But the Buddha doesn't present it that way. He says this is just one life of many. And then you can go, then you need to ask questions. Well, how's that possible? And why do I assume, for instance, that this life is all there is? So most of the times you find those assumptions will come out of your education. And basically just the way that people normally think. Just feels funny. Thank you.
Sorry.
So for most of us have been brought up with a sort of material science based on materialism. But the really only really important thing is everything physical. And all of our thoughts and consciousness comes out of the brain, which of course is a physical phenomenon. Right? So when the brain, when we die, the brain of course dies. That's the end. That's the presentation of most of science. So Buddhism disagrees with that. And the reason for the disagreement is based around cause and effect. So to say that the brain produces the mind doesn't make any sense from a Buddhist perspective. Because you've got a physical phenomena producing an effect that's quite dissimilar from it. This is, okay, so we're about, you know, they say for Western science, prove it, show it to me. They can't. It's an idea. There's no actual evidence that the seat of our consciousness is the brain. There's no evidence for that. But because it's based around materialism, we just assume that is the case. But the Buddhists go impossible because of cause and effect. Physical phenomena produce physical effects. Mental phenomena produce mental effects. And their presentation of phenomena is there are physical phenomena, and then there are non-physical phenomena. And then there's also phenomena that are a bit of both. Or like neither of those, but still phenomena. Now, for instance, I could say physical phenomena in the body. We all know that. Colour is another physical phenomena. There's lots of them, there's heaps of them. Okay, it's physical. Give me an example of something that's not physical. They don't say the mind. Why not? It has none of the characteristics of anything physical. None of them. What they have in common is impermanence. They're both subject to change. Yeah, so, okay, so give me an example of something that is neither of those two. It's not mental. And it's not physical. It's like cause and effect, karma, the person, this area. There's lots of concepts that exist, but they're not physical, they're not mental. So this is why they go, no, we disagree there. So anyway, so the thing is we have to practice Dharma. Our question should be, what is Dharma? What do you mean by that? There's a lot of different answers here, and the word Dharma's got 11 different meanings. So you've got to try and find one that resonates with you and go, this is what I mean when I say I have to practice Dharma. This is why I'm doing it. So quickly, just about Dharma. So Dharma is normally seen as that which holds you back from suffering. So you have to do something to hold you back from suffering. Most of our suffering is created by the mind. And there's a lot of suffering created by the mind in relation to our own death or the death of someone we care for. But, so you've got to, it's like, I've got to hold myself back from that. It's a fact that we're all going to die, but does it have to increase suffering? But the Buddha says, no, it doesn't. In fact, the fact of death does not produce the suffering. What produces the suffering is the aversion toward it taking place and the craving that it won't take place. You know, we say, I don't want to die, I don't want to die. That's where suffering is going to happen. Oh, no, I'm going to die, I'm going to die. That's where the suffering will take place, right? But just the fact that we die does not necessarily have to create suffering for us. It's just a fact. Anything born will die. So there's that part. So there's that, the fact that we will die. So this is, you know, a Dharma, it's just the truth about something. So we try to use the Dharma that holds you back from suffering. How do we get that? Through listening or through reading? Through, you know, that's one of the ways. The Dharma is called the Dharma of study. There's also the Dharma of realization, like when you don't suffer, like death is taking place and you're not suffering. That's the realization of Dharma. This Dharma again. The other Dharma is that we take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. What's the Dharma that we're taking refuge in there? The true paths and the true cessations. That's the actual refuge. It's like, in other words, the means to put an end to suffering and the ending of it. So that's basically the whole Buddhist path. You're doing that again and again and again. You're finding out that most of your suffering is created by your own thinking. You have to find, how am I thinking? That's what's causing my suffering. Then how do I stop it? And you stop it. That how do I do it? That's the path. It's the effort you put into stopping yourself from suffering. And when it stops, it's called a cessation. That's the Dharma. That's the actual Dharma. So that's what we have to try and do, you know, make it real for ourselves. And like I said, we have to do this like now. It's too late at the time of death. I'd suggest the best thing you can do if you've never practiced or if you're a beginner is relax. You can't stop this. Just relax as much as you can. Just try. Try to think of anything good. You know, think of the best person you know. Think of something you've done really well. Just anything positive, but get relaxed first. Don't say it. You can't stop death. Everyone's died. No need to freak out here. You've done it yourself again and again and again and again. You've died untold times. You're just about to do it again. Which leads us now to the second route called the time of death is uncertain. And this is the most important part of this whole meditation. This is what you've got to get in. Because like I said, you say, hey, I'm going to die. And say, yes, I want. So I want to. Yeah, no, we all are. So this is more important. When? That's not certain. And this is because the lifespan in this world system we're in, it is uncertain. You could die at any time. And for all sorts of reasons. Many of them are unknown. A few years ago, I read a story of a young Aboriginal girl. She was 14. They had high hopes for her being an athletic star. She was found dead on the track. They don't know why. Doctors examined it, no reason. Couldn't be found. A little while ago, same thing happened in America. This woman was maybe in her 20s. Same thing. Athletics, they fall out dead. Just sat down, she felt tired. Didn't get up. They don't know why. This is interesting. The causes of death are very many, and the causes of life few. So that's so to live, right? If you look at what you need to live, what do we need? What are some of the most basic things we need? Air, right? Water can kill you. Right? Air can kill you, but we need them both. The clothes you wear, we have to have clothes, right? Well, the clothes are good to you. Yeah, it's like everything that actually supports life can also kill you. But that's why there's so the causes are so many, or the things that actually support life, there's so few. That's if we're alive. Now that is just amazing, I think. I look at that, oh my God, we're alive in this moment in time. It really is to me like a miracle. And just like I said, at the very center, this body is very fragile. So my dad, like, he died gardening. Right? And it wasn't through a heart attack or anything, because he was gardening in bare feet. And this microorganism in the soil got up through into his skin, through his feet, and then he got this thing where his leg started to rot, and within 2 days he was dead. This is not uncommon. Other people have died just like this. He just didn't know. And he, yeah, when we feel the soil on his feet, and that's what happened. So even, you know, like I said, people try and get strong and build up immunities, and you can up to a point. There's many, many phenomena that can kill you. So this should tell us, so okay, I've decided I've got to practice Dharma. It's like, when? And the answer is like, right now. Here comes the next lot. So the time of death is uncertain. Like I said, so people, children, you know, you can die in the womb. You can die before you even come out into the world. We know this, right? As soon as you're born, you can die. But you can die before you're 1 year old. You can die when you're 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, all the way up to where we are now. There's no stable concept. Okay, we're all going to die at 40. No, it's not like the science fiction books. But it's any time. So here I've got this picture of the plague. So, you know, we just went through COVID, and it's like, that's like the modern plague, isn't it? And look what happened. A lot of people died. And so, you know, many of us, like, it's a funny thing, like going to the hospital, right? You think you're going to be protected there, and then we all know there's stuff in the hospitals that can kill you. Sometimes the people who are trying to help you, mistakes are made. And if it's not their mistake, maybe something happens with the technology. Now, my mate, one of my schoolmates, he got really sick when COVID came, so they couldn't treat him, and so he just died. There's some die in the womb, others at birth. Still others when they can crawl. Some when they can walk. Some are old, others are adults, going one by one, like fruit falling to the earth. There are a lot of really good quotes in this section on death and impermanence. Believe me, it's like you're reading and you go, yeah, it's like that, for sure. It doesn't, well, not to me at least, it doesn't freak you out. It's just telling you what's a fact. It's like this. You know, if you think wide enough, you go, yeah, it's just like that. It's just like that. And, you know, the question was, well, so what am I going to do? It often seems like there's nothing you can do, is it? I think what happens is the way we've been educated, it's like, well, there's nothing you can do. But the Buddha Dharma says, no, there's plenty you can do. You can die without fear, for instance. You can die without regret. You don't have to have the sufferings of dying. You can stop that immediately. Like I think I told you, when I came across this, I remember this really unkind thing that I did to the first girl I fell in love with. Right? She didn't return my affection. I got really upset. So I said something very cruel to her. And as soon as I said it, it affected me straight away. I didn't know that would happen, but it did. And when I came to become a Buddhist, like that's still always on my mind, right, that I did this thing. I thought, I've got to ring her up. I've got to say I'm sorry. I'm pretty sure if I died, I would think of that. It's terrible. hurtful thing I did. So no, that's not going to happen to me. It was the same with my dad. So I know I did a lot of things to my dad that made him really upset. He did a lot of stuff to me too. I thought, no, I don't want to die like that either. I don't want to be dying there thinking of things I did to my parents. So of course, you know, you pick the phone up or you write a letter, you say, I'm sorry. Because you know, sure, I don't want to die with that on my mind. In fact, I'd like to die knowing I wrote to my dad, I said, you know, I'm really sorry what I did, Dad. Yeah. So you can think, well, that was a good thing to apologize for the harms you've done in the past. This body is what it is. It's very fragile. It doesn't seem like it, especially when you're in good health, especially when you're young. You know, when you get older, you become sick more often. You probably end up going to the doctors more often. In fact, you go to any doctors and sit there, right, and you see the people come through, right? All the cars pulling up, especially the older people. So the body's usually hurt. So what to do? This, I have to practice like now. The wonderful thing about Dharma practice when he says this, remember, like Rinpoche used to say, the Dharma is just the tip of a wish. Actual Dharma is intention. That's the karma. You've got to try to maintain good thought, good intention to be in the world. It'll help you all the way through your life while you live life, but it'll carry beyond it. But try to find, give the deepest meaning you possibly can to your life, to go, this is why I'm living. This is the purpose of my life. Try and make it heartfelt and to you, it's for real, right? It's not, I mean, you make it up. You've got to make it up as real as you possibly can for yourself. And so if anyone tries to poo-poo it or make you regret it, you go, I don't care what you're saying. This is why I'm alive. This is my purpose for life. So that's your Dharma right there. Again, this is from Nagarjuna's precious guide. He says, look, your life dwells amongst the causes of death like a lamp standing in a strong breeze. So it's like that candle in the wind that Elton John sang. It's just like that. Just this brief light is gone. Yeah, so when you look out at night and you look up at the stars, right, and they're all bright, right? Yeah, they're all dead. Nearly all of them are dead stars. You're seeing the light of a dead star. It's taken millions and millions of years to get here. The star's not there anymore. All we see is the light of it. Like that blew me up when I first realized, I thought, wow, this is like a memory of a person. The person's not there. The memory is, but they're not there. And that's what we're relating to. So most of the stars in the sky are like that. So now we come to the third root. Oh no, sorry, this is the, no, no, this is the third root. Only Dharma practice helps at the time of death. So we've got, I must practice Dharma, I must practice Dharma now. They're the two conclusions. Why? Because death is certain and the time of death is uncertain. They're the two roots. Here's the third root. Only Dharma practice, only your own Dharma practice will help you at the time of death. So this is what will not help you, but this is what we normally rely upon for help. Usually, it's your friends. Now, when we require help, who do we reach out to? The people we know. They can't help you here. All their help is of a minimal assistance. Like if I knew you were dying, you wanted any, you know, come and do some practice with me, like, sure, I'd come to your bed in the hospital or at home. I'd tell you what I was about to do, blah, 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 blah. And so you might feel good about that. That's great. And I'd be telling you, like, positive thinking, like, positive thought, right, as much as you could. And that's about as much help as I could give you. I'd be willing to do it. But in the end, it's like, it comes back to you, right? No help as a friend is not a lot. Like, I can't stop you dying. I'll do my best to stop you being afraid. And that's what anybody will try and do. Right? So your friends won't help, or the help is minimal. But your good name, your wealth, that's a matter. All wealth. But when my wife died, it was quite strange. You know? The person that was always there is no longer there. And you open the closets, the shoes, the dresses, they're all there. The purse is still on the table. Her money, her cards, all that stuff's there, and she's not. And none of it stopped her death. So the resources don't help. And we put a lot of effort into life, don't we, to gather the resources. But they won't help at this time. And your body actually gives up on you. That's why you die. Right? The body gives up. Body doesn't help at this time. So the practice of Dharma you wish to engage in here is one of this period. So that's what I'm saying. You're going beyond this life now. This life is coming to an end. You're going beyond. So the Dharma that you've been practicing has to help you there. What you ever doing about Dharma about here, forget it, it's done. It helped you here, but not help you there. You want a Dharma that goes beyond this life. This is why it's so important to make, you know, when you start to practice, remember death. Aim for future higher rebirth, liberation, or enlightenment. They're the three goals. They're all beyond death. Liberation is a state beyond death. Enlightenment is beyond death. Higher rebirth is beyond the death of this life. So your practices have to be aimed that way, not for the happiness of this life. Like I said, once they asked a teacher, what is the result of practicing for this life? And he said, this life. That's the result. You get a happy life, this life. And I know myself, my life's been so much better since I come across Dharma. Much, much better. So it's been a good life now. But this life will come to an end. That's the thing. It's like, yeah, it was good. They're like, is that good that's going to take me beyond? You've got to be able to say yes to yourself. Yes, it will. Because my aim is beyond. So there's also that about purity, right? Don't confuse Dharma practice that's aimed at this life to be actual Dharma. It is, but it's not pure Dharma. Again, just quickly, though, you just go, this is not hard to do. Friends will not help. It's the same right now, right? When you call upon a friend to help you, they can help up to a point, can't they? Help put our mind at ease. They can do stuff. That's all true. But the one who has to actually make the difference, that's us. If our mind doesn't change in some way, we're still in trouble, no matter what the friend does. So it comes back to us again. It's the same with the resources. Right? Having money, having wealth does not mean you'll be happy. You can have a great house, you can have the money. There's plenty of people who have great houses and money and beautiful wives and children, and they're still not happy. That doesn't assure happiness. And of course, again, you know, we know this. The body just gives up on it. That's what it does. And if you look at how we live our lives, don't we really look after the body? And if you look at how you do that, how much assistance do I do? Spend the same assistance on my mind as I do my body? Most of us would probably go, no. Like I shower every day, no? Do you do purification practice every day? No. Not as well as I bathe. That's for sure. Do you eat every day? Yep. Do you practice concentration every day? No. Do you practice concentration as much as you eat? Yep. No. Do you practice generosity, like giving as much as you get? No. So, yeah, unless we ask ourselves these questions and check, we'll actually work out that. So how much time are we spending on Dharma? And not only that, but what's the quality of the time? So please, all I'm saying is don't give up on it. Don't go, it's all useless, it's too late for me. It's not. Miffy's mother, Inta, began in her 40s. I myself was only reached my 40s, it's the same thing. That's not okay. See it? And I'm just quite realistic about it. I go, look, I'm not going to achieve liberation this lifetime. You might say that to yourself. I don't think I can. I'm too old. I know what it requires. It's not like you know. You're going to get enlightened? I know. You're going to die? Yes. You think you can die with a positive mind? I can say yes. Why? Because I'm going to train myself to do it. If that's the minimum amount of Dharma that's required to get into a future rebirth and to carry on with the spiritual path, now that I've found it, I've got to do that. If I can't do that, like Rinpoche said, you've wasted your life. If you've come into the practice, you've brought to centers like this about Dharma, and you cannot die with a positive intention, you've wasted all your Dharma practice. You see that because what you're going to find in the next life, you won't be human. Because virtue is required. The most important thing is virtue, not the generosity, all those things, they're all virtues. It's a virtuous mind. So we've got to bring this positive state of mind up as much as we can while we're alive. Right? So it becomes easy at the time of death. Do as much as you can that's good while you're alive. Like I said, say sorry to the people you hurt. If they're passed away, just set that go in your heart. So over the weekend, we went to a memorial, and one of the people who'd been influenced by this man, she got up and gave a story. And this man had told her about his childhood and how he was living in Cook County. He said, I had a great childhood. My best friend was this Aboriginal man. And so there's a picture of him then. He's just this little boy, and this guy must have been in his late 50s or 60s. And John and this guy got on like a house on fire. And John had told this Aboriginal girl that he was now a mentor to about his life. You know? So when John passed away, she was right, she lives way up that area. So she went to have meet these people. Listen, so she found people associated, and they said, you have to go to his grave and you have to tell the story to the deceased. So I think that's like us, right? So we have relationships with people who have been very kind to us in our past and also who may have hurt us. So those who are kind, we appreciate them if we even think of them. But those who harmed us, it's very easy to think of them and not like them. So that's what we've got to get rid of. You know, we use the Buddhist thinking and go, yeah, all these sentient beings are under the control of delusions. They didn't really know what they were doing. They did the best they could, but they hurt me. They hurt lots of other people too. But because I understand I've got a bigger picture, I can let my own resentment go. I can forgive them. I understand. So we want to do this like now. Right? Most of us, I'm sure, will have hurts and resentments towards our parents, those closest to us, but they're the ones that hurt us quickly. So don't die with that on your mind, because it might come up at that time, right? We find it didn't come up. There's no way you can say it won't. You know, so try to get rid of as many resentments as you can. If the people are dead, forgive them in your mind. Use reasoning. In fact, yeah, when I was in prison, thinking about my own parents and the harms that my father did to me and my mother did to my sisters, you know, I wasn't a Dharma student then, but I was just lying there and think about it, and all I could see was the harm, and I was thinking there's something wrong with my picture, because nobody is all bad; they must have done some good. But it took quite a bit of work to try and work out like what that good was. And I had to start with very simple things like feeding me. Like, you know, there's plenty of people starving around the world, isn't there? They couldn't get a feed. But now my mother fed me. Oh, she also fed all my mates too. She used to invite them over. Dad was a bit harder, you know. But then I know he bought school shoes. He went to work and his money was spent on us. So having it those little things, it was very, very hard to find something where he was emotionally kind, where he said a kind word. That was very hard to find. But I knew he acted kindly, even though he might not have thought that, but I thought it was kind. Because there's plenty of parents that go, seven kids, like, see ya. You know, fathers just take off, or mothers go crazy. That didn't happen. And then there's the fact that you're alive. Like you go, you know, if mum and dad didn't give birth to me, I wouldn't be here. So anything good that was experienced in your life, that's because they gave birth to you. So even if they do harm you and that sort of thing, you know, you can come to that and go, well, here I am in this world and I can make all these decisions. I can follow a spiritual path. I can choose what I want. That's because I'm alive. You know, thanks, Mum. Thanks, Dad. Even if they're not here, in your own heart, you can say thank you and let go of the resentments. You know, again, understanding, they don't really know what they're doing, just like us. Right? We don't really know what we're doing. We're just trying to do the best we can. And we make all sorts of mistakes. You know, yeah, just like them. To accept the positive and negative karmic seeds, we enter the hereafter with nothing. Nobody can accompany us. Before that time, become a treasury of spiritual knowledge. So I really love that line, a treasury, right? Like, you've got to become your own treasury. You've got to have all your stuff, your mental wealth. There you go. I've provided for myself. Mum and Dad gave me life. I've provided for myself. I've got all these positive ways of thinking and being in the world. I'm ready for death. No problems. So the Dharma we practice must be pure. And it's super show that this is the only reliable guide, Bodhicitta. This is the greatest reliable guide. Of course, this is this intention of saying, okay, I'm dying. I will die. Let me die with the intention to become a Buddha. So I can be of immense help to anybody that ever comes into my sphere of influence. And I only have a mind that's positive. I don't have any disturbing emotions. I only have this great mind that knows is omniscient and wants to help others. Let my next rebirth be that. So the most important thing to think of this is like these three roots, right? Death is certain, time is uncertain, only practice, pure Dharma practice will help you. That's the most important thing to take away from this. What's of secondary importance is those nine reasons, because they back up these statements. You know? The easiest thing to remember, of course I'm going to die, death is certain. That's easy, no brainer. If you remember that, what's the point of saying that to yourself and not saying it? Well, the point is to reduce your attachment and your aversion. Like I said, whatever you're attached to, hey, guess what? You have to leave it. It can't come with you. If it's wealth, fame, name, a person, a house, whatever, it's not coming with you. You have to leave it. In terms of the aversions, guess what? That goes with you. Right? You don't want that with you. You do not want to be dying there with, you know, bitterness, thinking about all the things that somebody else should have done for you, or the harms you've done to others. Yeah, okay, that's right. No, I don't want that. So this recollection of it actually helps to reduce anger and attachment. The meditation itself is to generate a sense of urgency. It's like every morning when you wake up, like I said, you know, my line is, man, how lucky I am to still be alive today. You open your eyes, you're still alive. Well, how lucky I am to still be alive today. And you go, yeah, because death could take place at any moment. It's just that I'm not dead now. But I could get out of bed and fall over in the shower. No. In fact, one of the books I bought was all the different ways you can die. Oh, my God. And it's the way people have actually died. And there's some of the strangest things you can have. So it's quite, you know, humorous, funny. But it tells you there's all sorts of ways you could die.
A side effect of this was because this is a few times I've done this course of you, Eddie.
Yeah.
That after the very first time I did it, it really struck me that I didn't want to die. I didn't want my parents to die without me thanking them. So I actually wrote a letter to my dad, because my dad's a bit of a character. But after he passed away, when we went through his belongings, we found my letter and I'd forgotten about it. And my brother actually read it and I basically thanked him for all the things that he did for us. And my brother said, yeah, that's about right. Like, you know, that's good. Like, dad got a thank you letter from you as the eldest on behalf of all the siblings. So that's another thing that comes out of thinking about death, is you don't waste time going, I'll do that later. You go, no, I need to tell mum and dad.
Yeah,
thank you.
Yeah, that was the same thing. You get the sense of urgency. I've got to act now. And you can, and you should, you know, as fast as you can. Ross? So if the conditions are right. And so, of course, you know, this is what they'll do, Ross, is you look at this and go, okay, so I'm going to practice dying with this positive thought. You go, yep, that will give you a human rebirth. You go, do you need anything else? Yeah, for sure. Resources. Yeah, okay. What are the causes for the resources? And they say generosity. So it's not something to give, it's the intention to give. So when you give people, no matter what the gift is, intend to become awakened for their benefit. Wish that they become enlightened through your gift. So it's what they call the perfection. So yes, this attitude will get you a human rebirth, but you need more. And we all know that. So then it's like, okay, so here are the causes to get you the more. So you find out what those are and you do that too. Let's do a meditation.
It might affect you.
Okay, so if you say no aversions go with you, you'd have to say so no positives go with you. No, nothing goes with you.
That's right.
Right? So then what's the point? So what's going to happen?
Well, maybe nothing.
But there's
something to discuss.
So if there was nothing to go with you, then how about this life? Does nothing go with you from what you did when you were 10 to now?
If you believe that reincarnation...
No, I'm not about reincarnation. I'm talking about mind. The things that you've done in your past, have they affected your present?
Well, is there evidence for that?
Of course there is. The fact that you can speak, you got taught that, isn't it? You were taught that before you didn't know how to speak. You were taught how to speak. And now, of course. Mm-hmm. And now you can speak.
Yes.
There's a cause and an effect that took place. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing. So this is not belief. It's just
the
like,
reincarnation.
Yeah, but that's guessing, right? That's not the thing, that the speech is just an example. So everything that you know now, where did it come from?
Well,
we have to debate. It doesn't require debate. It's simple.
If you
And that function happened before you were able to speak or after? No, just answer the question. Was it in this life, or you taught to speak in this life so you can speak now?
Yes.
Thank you. Cause, effect. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing. In this life, any other life, anything that's produced is an effect. Has to have a cause, and it's got to be supported by conditions. If it's not, it's come out of nowhere. That doesn't make sense anyway you think of it. So it's the same thing. It's consciousness. It's causal. It produces effects. Whether it's in this life, like I said, if you look at this life, I go, so when you were 10 and 11, that is not your age. How old are you now?
54.
Okay, so 54, between 53 and 54, you are not 10 and 11, are you? No, none of us are, right? But what happened between 10 and 11 could have some effect on you when you're 53 and 54. Of course, in this life.
Yes.
Right. It's the same thing across any life, any time of consciousness. That's all you have to just work it out like that. It's really simple. Right? So it's like that, cause and effect there. Then, in terms of the rebirth states, just look around cats, dogs, animals. Do they think they have consciousness or not? Do they have feelings? If you say yes, then we would say that's associated with mind and consciousness, because that's what mind does, it feels. That's the idea. So why have they got that body and not our one? Why are we not them? So the Buddhists would say this is because of the major characteristics on your mind at the time of rebirth. They would say you didn't have enough virtue. It's virtue that decides what the form you take. So that's like I said, non-virtue produces higher rebirth states, which is human being and upwards. Non-virtue produces lower rebirth states. That's the presentation. But this question about previous lives, just look at this life. You've had all these lives in this life. You've had the life of between 10 and 11, 11 to 12, 13 to 14, on and on and on. And now you've got this one. The life that you're living now is the future life you weren't having when you were 10 and 11.
That's good.
Again, again, just look at this way. Mm-hmm. When you do something, like for me, I'll take my life, right? So I've done a lot of bad things. I got away with it for quite some time. But suppose, like I used to be, I would sell you some drugs, right? It's against the law. I get away with it. I get away with it for 2 years, right? 2 years ago, suddenly I'm caught. Now, what I did there has an effect over here. It's the same thing. Just extend the life, just extend the time period. You go, what happens? I got away. Nothing, 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 nothing. Something. And you just up, make it make sense for you living your own life as an example. In a period of time, just extend it. And go, if consciousness doesn't stop, like the Buddhists are saying, it goes, then the effect's going to take place. Otherwise, you're looking at these effects and going, what caused it? Yeah. So Buddha's big teaching is cause and effect. And he says that if you decide to become a Buddhist, the first thing you do to act as a Buddhist is to work on Buddha's presentation of cause and effect. He says that every effect has a cause. And it's just the timeline gets expanded, that's all. Yeah. So,
other teachings also deal a little bit different with this. So
that's sure, but they might not be the Buddhist teaching. Because the Buddhist teaching, of course, is different. Okay, so there's two ways of concentration. One is called the worldly concentration, one is a Buddhist concentration. Worldly concentration is when you concentrate on outer objects. objects of the senses, right? You know, you can constantly, you can see a pair of shoes in the window, concentrate your mind on it, think about that shoe. Or you can read a book and be concentrated just reading. Right? So this is concentration we're familiar with already. The fact that you're sitting here listening to me is concentration. Right? Now, let's stop reading. That's not the Buddhist concentration we're talking about. That's not Buddhist concentration. That's just concentration. So the objects of Buddhist concentration are inert. They're mental objects. They're not physical objects. Right? Now, the way to develop this inner mental concentration is basically like there's two real major ways you can do it. One is you have to have a mental object and you need to fix your mind on it. That's how you concentrate. That's why these objects like Buddhas imagine them, they're inner objects, they're mental objects. It's to help you concentrate on them. Other mental objects are, for instance, virtues, but they're not out there. Love is a mental virtue. It's not out there. So you need to find out what love is and concentrate on it. It's inward concentration. When you know what a disturbing emotion is or any of the negative things, you have to concentrate on it and know what it is, how you're affected by it, so you can go, no. That's the sort of result I get. I need to move the mind away from it. But you've got to know what it is first. Boy, now we're way over time, aren't we? Okay, so let's see. I've dropped that first meditation. Just do the last one. So, like I said, it's very hard to convince a 16-year-old to meditate on death. Probably the most, I don't know, the most, you know, of course you don't want to kill somebody to go there, people die, right? But that does work. You know, to see death for real, it's a big deal. But I thought, the thing at 16, what I never liked at 16 was like getting confused and getting upset. Like the mental stuff that you go through when you're young. Right? Some of that's, man, does your head in. And you know, there's a number of young people that come here and I can see, Jesus, like what happened to you? And I figure, hey, the only way you get like that is taking a lot of bad drugs. Right? You know, so why did you do that? You go, I'm unhappy. I agree. Of course you're unhappy. And you try and get out of unhappiness, right? So you try something, the stuff you do as a kid. Right? So I'm thinking, okay, then recollecting death really stops bad thinking and the bad actions that follow. Now, I can say something, okay. So I've done this in my own, you know, mind. I play mental games with myself lots of times. And so one of them is like, you just put a gun to your head or get someone to point a gun at your head. And so you got 3 seconds and then you're dead. What are you going to do? If you're doing really stupid stuff, it's like, well, do you want to keep doing that for the next 3 seconds before I blow your brains out? You probably go, no. Right? Well, that didn't work. I don't know, we're going to work for 16-year-old, we've got to try and figure something out. You know, the point of it is really to try and work it out on yourself. If you could find someone to stop you at 16, it'd probably stop you now. Most of us are probably sillier when we're 16 than we are now, right? So that's what I sort of suggest. Yeah, that's what I was trying to get at. It's like an actual death. That's the thing that wakes you up. Yeah. Your mother dies, or your brother dies, or somebody really close to you dies, your life changes. But you're not the same after that. So this is what I'm saying, that the recollection of death stops all this crazy thinking. So the thought of death and delusion shatters like a hammered stone. Okay, so again, what's interesting, but we're right on time. So let's do our last, this meditation. We can do at least one meditation. Get comfortable in your seat, please. Just drop your shoulders, relax your back, relax your shoulders. Get comfortable. Let your breath become steady and calm as your body breathes itself. So if you're listening to this presentation on the meditation of death, the three roots, the nine reasons, the three conclusions. So now I want you to generate an intention for yourself. So you're listening to this meditation, you're about to engage in a meditation, why? Okay, you've set your meditation. Now this life is impermanent. It's subject to change. There's no moment that ever stays the same. This life is finite. It will come to an end. It's very, very precious while we have it because you can do a great deal with it. So what do you want to do with this life? The awareness of death clarifies your purpose in life. All of the disturbing emotions like hatred, like jealousy, like pride, all of these decrease and diminish viewed against the brevity of life, the shortness of life. Like a really potent medicine, the awareness of death transforms selfish desire into a determination of meaning. So just ask yourself now, if today were to be your very last day of this life, what would you prioritize? What would you do? So can you see how this awareness of death can guide your decisions on how you live each day? So you can try to integrate the ideas of this practice in every day. Like when you get up in the morning, how wonderful it is to still be alive today. What would I do today if this were my last day on earth? By asking this question, you can commit yourself to living with intention and compassion. So I think that's probably not a bad way to live. To live compassionately, meaning non-harmfully, and with an intention, a very serious intention. Because this life is short. It can come to an end at any moment. And when this life comes to an end, another life will begin. How do you want to enter that new life? And now just come back to your breath, relax, relax. Exhale, and just let your eyes flutter open. There's another quote from the Buddha, and he says, of all ploughing, ploughing in the autumn is supreme, means it's easiest, it's best. Of all footprints, the elephant's is supreme, it's the deepest. Of all perceptions, remembering death and impermanence is supreme. So I read this on the teachings, an enlightened person said this, right? He said, of all my teachings, this is the one. This is the greatest teaching you can take with it. In fact, when the Buddha, the first teaching he gave was on this, it was the very last teaching he gave, was on death and impermanence. And then he says, become an island unto yourself. You have to protect yourself. So today I've shared with you these three roots. Death is certain, the time of death is uncertain, only my practice of what I know to be true will help. I have to practice that now, and I have to be pure about it. Right? You have to convince yourself. You listen to me. Every other teacher will try and convince you to do the same thing. But in the end, it's up to each of us. We're the ones that have to go, think about it and go, okay, right? Or not, up to you. So next week, I'm going to introduce you to these five practices you can do while you're dying, before you actually die, but like you're sitting there and you go, okay, I'm dying. This is five forces. This practice, there's lots of different practices you can do. Lama Yeshe did this when he was dying. Right? He had all these tantric initiates that, no, not doing any of them, I'm doing this one. When Inter, if his mother was dying, she had Vajrayogini practice. She also had high Shaka tantric practices. Lama Zopa said, do this one. This is the simplest. And it's really effective. In fact, one time Miffy and I had a disagreement about how to teach a death and dying class, and we asked Lupashai, he said, you know, ask him, I've got a question. I said, I think this, and Miffy thinks this. And he just sat there and he went, he didn't say either, but he said, I think this. And he told us, and I go, yeah, you're right. So ever since I thought, this is the one to do. Okay, so let's, again, just thank you for being here and listening. It's not an easy topic to think about. Thank you online and people here. So let's dedicate now your willingness to listen to this material and to think about it, and perhaps even to put something into practice. So please join me in saying, due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. May the supreme jewel, Bodhicitta, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline but increase forevermore. And as long as space remains, as long as human beings remain, may I too remain to dispel the sorrows of the world. May in the prayer for his holiness. The wish-granting, wish-fulfilling jewel, source of every single benefit and happiness in this world, to the incomparably kind, Tenzin Gyatso, I beseech. May all your holy wishes be spontaneously fulfilled. And finally, with a prayer for Rinpoche's new reincarnation to come amongst us as quickly as possible. In holding and spreading the moon is precious and complete teachings through explanation and practice, you wore the armor of patience and never discouraged. Incomparable, venerable Guruji, I make this request.